coming up this episode.
One of my biggest gripes is that I don't think there's enough practical engineering taught in a degree. It's very theoretical. I think you need to be able to get your fingernails dirty. Lucas, famously the company known as the Prince of Darkness.
Right. Why are they known as that?
Oh, well, back in the day, when Lucas made electronics for the British car industry, they weren't the most reliable.
Right,
so
okay.
Cars
right.
broke down frequently, often using Lucas product.
Right, okay.
Not the case these days, I'm sure, in case their lawyers are listening. And so for me, the idea of packing a bag and jumping on a plane was completely normal. I had a label put around my neck age 6 and put on a plane in Hong Kong to go to school on my own. I had to lay 4 guys off who I considered to be essential to the business. I respected them, and to look them in the eyes and say, I'm sorry I'm letting you go, was the worst thing I ever had to do, and I vowed afterwards I would never do it again. So.
Hello, welcome back to Wall Plug and Grommet. I'm Roger Bradbury, the owner at Wren Construction and Chime Software.
Hello, I am Ellie, and this is a podcast where we chat through a top topic in construction, as well as interviewing an industry expert to see how they got into construction and what advice they can give us.
Excellent. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks. How are you?
Not bad. As you may be aware, I slightly hurt my back the other day, but I'm trying to...
On the mend.
Yeah, soldering on. Anything for a podcast, so here I am.
Well, glad to have you in.
I've got a special chair that you've given me today.
I know. We've got our wobble stools. They're pretty good, actually.
It's good, actually. It's way more comfortable than the car on the way in, so might have to stretch every now and again, mid-pod, just to...
Well, I did my neck in 2 weeks ago. What are we like?
I know. Release the tension. What have you done about your neck? Got anything done? Any treatments?
Of Valium.
Valium. Yeah.
Anyway.
We've gone off page.
What's our hot topic?
Very serious topic today, Els.
Very serious.
It's how do we get, I think we're going to title it, Where Have All the Young Guns Gone? Does construction have a culture problem?
Interested in this because we do have a problem as an industry that we don't attract youngsters. Yeah. And I mean, there's been lots in the news about construction's got an aging workforce. They're all going to retire. A lot of them are going to retire in the next 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
And the numbers aren't balancing out. What is the issue with construction? Why? Because I do feel like it's an industry that you get into. A, if you know someone, so your family member's in it already, or someone closely connected to you, I think that's a reason. Or, unfortunately, the other reason is because you can't do anything. You know,
you fall into it, maybe.
Yeah, but I think because you think, oh, I can't do this. No, don't have the grades for this. I'll just do construction.
Right.
Which is... Not, you know, for an industry, because we've got loads of great people in it.
I think it depends what job role within.
Yeah.
Because I think, again, it's the broad nature of the industry. You've got mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, structural engineers, brickies, carpenters, quantity surveyors, decorators. There is a point at which you say, well, when do you know you want to become one of those? And I think, actually, really, this is a discussion about education as much as it is about, and I say education, the education sector, to how we get our workforce... The industries that are really well joined up, have got a good message going out, have maybe got some preconceived glamorous perceptions of them. So, for example, the IT, the technical world, you know, kids don't need massively encouraged at a young age to think that tech is a great future for them.
Why is that? What are tech offering that we're not offering? Because I believe we can,
they've got the messaging app. I agree. We can. Yeah.
We just, as an industry, rubbish at marketing ourselves?
I think that is probably a very good point, because and marketing is one of those things. It's subtle, isn't it? Really, are people aware that of the positives and the negatives? But are people generally aware of this as a choice? If the answer is no, then they've clearly got their messaging wrong, and therefore it is a marketing problem, I suppose.
Yeah, it's twofold. I think we've got a marketing problem, and it's got historically a bad reputation.
Yeah.
Like, even me, I came into construction late after being a teacher in my 30s. And I feel like even I was a bit hesitant to get into it. And then when people would ask what I do.
Embarrassed, maybe?
not like fully embarrassed, but it was,
I know what you mean.
It wasn't
though.
Like I was like singing from the rooftops. Yeah. It was, oh, I work in construction. You know, it was always with a bit of a caveat.
But, yeah. It's really good.
And I don't do that now.
No,
and
that's
I really.
So do you think that's because you've seen it from the inside and therefore you really, warts and all, maybe?
Yeah, and I really believe in it as an industry. And I think it's such a diverse, exciting industry. But, and I'm really on the periphery. I'm not on site every day. I don't see the internet.
But building,
so I'm
it's not just about, as
no,
we've discussed.
No, of course it's not.
It's far from that. You've got the office jobs, the site jobs.
Yeah, but I still fundamentally think we do have to shift our mindset into a more, without being all like Silicon Valley. I'm not saying we have to be all, you know, well, maybe ping pong tables would help, but
beanbags. I think that's great. And I think you'll probably find that is to some degree, as always with construction. I think that will be happening. I think,
yeah.
I bet if you look at some of the, even at Wren, we've got a gym, I'm sat behind our gym at the moment. We've got a little gym, which, you know, for me is a great way to sort of express to everybody that we care about their health. You know, we build a gym, you can use it.
Got a sauna.
We encourage
not
you.
Not plugged in yet, but we've got a sauna.
Doesn't work. it's currently storage for golf clubs, isn't it? And people's fishing equipment. It's getting those younger people to get into the industry. And is that really about thinking how young people think? I was chatting to the guy that edits this earlier, weren't we, Freddie? And he was saying that in the property market, you know, the young guys are going out taking TikTok videos of mansions, and so they're using
and so the youngsters to their advantage. Yeah. They've got so much to offer. I know, and I think it's as employers giving people freedom and that autonomy to go.
Yeah, how do we get them in?
Exactly. So how do we get?
So surely education. This is your department of expertise, Bells.
See, but I do think marketing as well. Like education, yes. But if we're thinking more creatively, we were talking earlier about how the army were having issues with recruitment, and then they brought out their advert, "Be the best,"
which was brilliant. Yeah, I agree.
And it worked.
You can see how if you're a 16-year-old chap or lady, girl, that, you know, those it makes me want to join the army, to be fair. Do you know what I mean? It makes me think, God, what was I doing at 18? How fun does that look? Now, whether or not it's really like that. But that's neither here nor there. It's marketing. It's a strong message.
What are our selling points, do we think, for youngsters? Like,
There you go. So it's the same sort of things, arguably. It's the camaraderie, you know, the part of a team. I think one of the best things about building is you move from project to project, team to team. You build relationships quickly with people. That's a selling point. You know, at the camaraderie that you get, the friendships that you build. Then you've got,
you're not staring at a screen all day.
No,
like, actually, that's appealing,
yeah,
I think,
active.
To your,
yeah.
You
no,
know,
I think,
you're
I,
active.
I agree, yeah.
And from morning to when you leave in the afternoon, you've actually done something. You've built something. You've drawn something.
Yeah,
you
I
know,
couldn't
you
agree
really
more.
Have.
I think that's one of the best things about being in building, is there's an end to what you're doing. And so you can look back. We all talk about, oh, I did that job. I mean, you might have just made the tea. But you feel connected to the job.
Yeah.
You know, people walking past, the gherkin, the dad will say, oh, you know, I did that job, like the plumber. But he did do that job. You know, he feels part of that job. And I think that's really powerful. And I get that across. And I think you could also play on the, you know, money in the hand. You're 16, 17, you know, you can go down to the pub with your mates and get your round in. Don't be, you know, it's not slink to the back of the queue, dodging you around all night.
Yeah, anyway. So it's money, team, and that, like, real sense of achievement each day.
And sustainability, you know, we're always going to be building, no matter what happens with regards to the way we build, or, you know, where the sort of drivers are. So in the moment, obviously, it's sort of a green agenda. That, to me, that just says, well, there's loads of jobs that are going to come. You know, there's going to be sustainability, security.
So should we see what Batesy's got to
give
us? Batesy's Bites.
Batesy's Bites. Mate, I'll just pass you over to him. He's just boring somebody at the moment.
Nice one. Well done. Quick one, mate. Thinking about, we're just about to go into our pod, and our question is, how do we get younger people to join the industry? And we thought we'd give you a shout, see if you've got any thoughts.
What we need to do is start what I did for Rush and Tompkins, go to the local schools.
Ah, that's exactly. So what, the education?
Go to it at the point of education with the thing about the multitude of careers that are available in construction.
Yeah.
And the day release course, and do they release courses, but you need to understand what the local colleges are offering as well.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. No, brilliant. I think we'll talk about that. That's exactly, that's perfect. All right, mate, best shoot.
All right, mate.
Nice one. Care. Cheers, pal.
Cheers.
A very good point.
That
as always, you know,
he comes up with it. He'll bring it back to him, but he comes up with the goods.
He does, and I think, and that's what I was trying to get at earlier. Yeah. I really do believe you've got to work with the education department to ensure that they know what skills they're basically getting these kids ready for. Essentially, school, I suppose, in our capitalist system, is about preparing the people for the workforce. So they need to know what the workforce demands, you know, and it brings you back to the questions of, you know.
Which I totally agree with that. But kids have so much else going on in their head as well that if they're seeing videos about Google, you know.
Well, I think the videos are being done as well. And chatting.
Yeah, I think, absolutely. Like you were saying, you'd seen that YouTuber.
Asheville Aggregates.
Yeah.
Daniel Luisi or something.
So like he's that. Actually, I think that route. So, yes. Go into schools, I totally agree, but it's got to be alongside this culture.
But arguably,
shift.
It's already happening, you see, we're just behind.
So, we're going to start making YouTube videos. Oh, God.
Oh, no.
Day in the life of Roger Bradbury.
And Ellie Elworthy. Five views, both by me and you. Both or five by me and you.
Cool, so we'll get Clive in. Today we are so thrilled to have you on. You have gone from mechanical engineer to MD and founder of Apex Circuit Design, creating motorsports destinations around the world, and have become one of the world's leading race circuit designers. Thanks for coming in, Clive. It's great to have you on.
It's a pleasure, Ellie. Thank you for inviting me.
Nice to see you, Clive. Nice to see you.
Hi, Roger.
We really want to know, how did you first get into mechanical engineering? Did you always know you wanted to be a mechanical engineer?
Tragically, I'm one of those Dilbert characters who has the knack.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you've ever seen that cartoon, but it was clear from a very, very early age that I knew that I was going to be an engineer. My parents were appalled.
Well, good at Lego.
Good at Lego. I could tell them what cars were when I was 2 years old.
Oh, wow.
Right.
So you knew you wanted to go from school. Did you do maths at A-level?
I did maths. I did further maths. I did physics. I wanted to do maths, physics and English, but the school said that they couldn't fit that into the curriculum, which annoyed me because I think that English is one of the most important languages that you should use well, even in England.
So you studied at uni for, was it a three-year course?
It was a three-year course. In fact, it took me four. I spent too much time mucking around with the Portsmouth Poly Motor Club.
Good man.
Yeah. So you were already, you already had your eyes on cars there.
Oh yeah, unfortunately, yeah. It's super uncool, I know, for many people to have that kind of an attraction to things mechanical, but it is also it's a calling. It was always clear that I was going to be an engineer.
I suppose there was a point when mechanical engineering was the sort of new technology as well, wasn't it? And that's kind of maybe been overtaken with other technologies to some degree. And so people seem to look at it as maybe almost archaic, you know, mechanical workings, but really underpinned pretty much everything, right?
Indeed. And I think that education in engineering as a general term is brilliant for anybody for the simple reason it teaches you how to solve problems. Mm. So I've got friends, in fact, I've got family who studied engineering at university and they've worked in banking or architecture. And the knowledge that you get from being taught how to solve a set of problems using basic principles and then remembering, because you do need to remember quite a lot, is allegorical to life. And you're very easily able to break a complex problem down into small, easy parts to make things happen.
And you don't get taught that at school.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Like the current, I
used to be a teacher and it's really
it's like
missing.
Critical analysis and all these sorts of
things. I mean, they are doing critical thinking a bit more, and it's actually in Europe they're better at teaching sort of that critical thought process. But, you know, to learn it only at uni seems so late. Like,
well,
you
even
should.
University's quite poor when it comes to teaching the proper real world stuff.
Yeah.
In fact, it wasn't until I had my graduate training program at Rolls that I was taught how to make stuff. More recently, in the last 15 years, I've been invited along to the Brunel University School of Engineering to their annual, let's give the academics a hard time from industry.
Right, okay, group. That sounds like a good group.
They they don't much like to be told.
No.
Actually, you need to be producing people who understand the sort of tools that are necessary to be employable. And they're obviously, they've got their hands tied behind their back because there's syllabuses that are set by governments. Yeah. They've got processes that are embedded almost to a man or a woman. They've done this their way for a couple of centuries.
Yeah.
And so getting change in the educational system isn't easy, but it is happening.
That's interesting. I think it's a fascinating point because that's exactly where I sort of feel. We were agreeing, weren't we, that... So tell us what you think about that. How is the... Yeah, if it's changing, that's interesting.
Well, one of my biggest gripes is that I don't think there's enough practical engineering taught in a degree. It's very theoretical. And I think you need to be able to get your fingernails dirty.
Yeah, I think you need to... we've talked about this in the past, of whether, well, or whether you sometimes bypass, you, perhaps not for mechanical engineering, but for a lot of degrees, maybe just...
Well, is the classroom the right place for
it? Yeah, should you be on site? Should you be in the field and maybe do rotation? Like doctors?
Yes.
They're like in there straight away, aren't they?
Well, that's why I think these sandwich courses
are... They're like mechanics, aren't they? They're doctors in some ways.
They are.
Exactly.
They are.
But they're doing practical work from day one. They're not in classrooms for their 5 years training.
Funny enough, never looked too hard into
how to become a doctor.
Well, I think that... certainly, my experience of bringing in young engineers today, we started a protocol with Brunel, but we now do it much more with Bath University, where we'll get hold of undergrads who have done 2 years of their bachelor's course. Yeah. They'll spend a year in industry with us, and then they'll go back for a further 2 years where they finish their bachelor's course, do their master's, and then they're on the market. And as a mindset, we've always made sure that we're trying to create mini CEOs out of these guys. So we'll expose them to multiple different elements of what we do because we're a small enough business to be able to do that. If you're in a big blue chip, it's quite difficult to get people to bounce around between departments. But in a small entity like ours, actually, it's essential that you know how to make a proposal or to build a resource plan or to draft something or
manage
to
budgets.
All of those things are critical to what we do, and I make sure that it's not just making cups of tea that these guys do.
So was Rolls-Royce your... That wasn't your placement. That was your first job.
That was my first job.
Yeah. So talk us a bit, because I know you've found that a great experience.
I have to say that if it weren't for that, I doubt very much that the career I've had would have happened.
Yeah. Wow.
Largely due to the fact that, A, the Rolls-Royce graduate training program even then was seen as the best. Right. I don't say it probably still is. Yeah. And their attitude to training and their attitude to treating each of their new recruits as, you know, rough diamonds ready to be polished was second to none.
That's brilliant.
And I learned things like contract law. I learned things like manufacture or design for manufacture. And
so what was your role there? As I mean, was it a graduate role that did that, or was there a specific role that you were...
I wanted to be involved in the commercial side. I've always had a bit of a commercial bent, and so to go into a pure engineering role was not something that was particularly exciting me.
Sure.
Roles were good, actually, because they realised that they couldn't put me into their sales or marketing team because I didn't have a degree in marketing or economics.
Right.
Instead, they realised that I wanted to get involved in something to do with supply chain, so they put me into the raw material purchase department.
Okay.
And by chance, and certainly serendipitously, I was put under the control of a guy called John Lee, who I don't know where he is these days. I wish I could find him.
He might be listening.
Who was, by some margin, the most inspirational boss I've ever had.
Oh, wow.
Because he taught me those really crucial rules, like don't micromanage someone, give them the tools to do their job well, make sure that they feel empowered to do those, and tell them if they've done a good job, and also tell them if they screwed up.
Yeah.
And make sure that your door is open so that if you've got a question, they can, or they've got a question,
feel
they can ask you.
They saw you as an individual. Mm. They pinpointed what you wanted and they, you know, helped you to grow, and you did.
I did. I felt quite guilty when the time came to say, thank you, I'm moving on.
No, I bet,
So how long were you there?
Just over 2 years. I had two job offers when I finished my degree. One was from Rolls-Royce and the other was from Lucas Gerling. And Lucas, famously the company known as the Prince of Darkness.
Right. Why are they known as that?
Oh, well, back in the day, when Lucas made electronics for the British car industry, they weren't the most reliable.
Right, and so okay.
Cars
right.
broke down frequently, often using Lucas product.
Right, okay.
Not the case these days, right, I'm sure, right. in case their lawyers are listening.
No. Definitely not the case with Rolls-Royce.
And so from Rolls, you then wanted to go into a more commercial yes. role, is that right?
That's right. And I also wanted to travel. I grew up as an army brat. My dad was in the army.
Right.
I lived in
okay.
Hong Kong, yeah, and Malaya, and places
yeah.
like that.
Yeah. Did you travel much? No, I feel like
to you Germany, don't. Scotland, York. Yeah. Yeah, wasn't no, that luxury.
I was lucky, and I had a charmed childhood. And so for me, the idea of packing a bag and jumping on a plane was completely normal.
Nature,
I had a label put around my neck, age six, and put on a plane in Hong Kong
wow.
to go to school
yeah.
on my own. You do notice when you get young undergrads into a company, and we have on average two, sometimes okay. three a year.
Yeah. Okay, so it's a regular so soon,
it's
soon enough.
So it's a sausage enough. Machine.
Yeah.
And some of them are utterly brilliant.
Yeah.
And those are the ones who we then give a bursary to for their final 2 years and then offer them a job. And a lot of them come back and, mm-hmm. and stay with us. And we have a very low turnover of staff. Some of them are a bit wet.
Yeah.
And you have to hold their hands absolutely everywhere. And the idea of graft
right, that's it.
Really okay. doesn't work.
Yeah.
Now, that's not really a criticism of a generation. I think it's a criticism of a parenting style, yeah. personally.
Not just human beings. Yeah. You know, some of them were.
It's not the individual's fault, because I think a child, you know the old Jesuit thing that said, give me the boy at seven, I'll give you the man.
Yes. I'm reading a book similar to that, yeah. Raising Boys.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I've read that. It's great.
And so there is, from the point when a child is seven, they've established their personality for life.
Right, it's interesting.
And oh, gosh.
And so what you then have to do is give them, you've established in them ethics,
some
you've
values.
Established values, yeah. you've established the identity of right and wrong. Yeah. All you're then doing is giving them a toolbox
yeah.
from that point forwards.
Yeah, no, it's just fascinating, isn't it? How to, I mean...
And that continues
children.
Into the 20s, yeah. I might add.
No,
so
no.
your childhood doesn't end. Actually, to be honest with you, one of my best friends and another of the influencers I had in my career at the age of 60 turned around to me once and said, Clive, there's only two types of men. They're boys and old men. What are you?
Yeah, it's good. It's a good point, isn't it?
So true. Okay, so you were traveling the world. We had Nick Morley on before and he, has a very glamorous lifestyle going around. So have you been to countless countries?
Well, I do keep a log. I'm at 97.
No.
Really? Mm. What happened after Rolls? Yeah.
Well, post Rolls, I joined this company called Wright Machinery, and they were based in Uxbridge, and they made equipment for the food industry. Their real focus was on the snack food industry, but they produced everything for conveying for frozen industry, as well as packaging and production facilities.
So they had production facilities where they made...
So they made stuff.
Stuff, yeah.
And that stuff got sold around the world. They were market leaders in their field. And again, rather like what I do today, a niche. And yeah. so to be able to survive as a business like that, you needed to be ubiquitous. You needed to be
everywhere. Yeah.
And so they had a team of about four people, by the time I joined them, who were looking after their technical sales. And again, I was very fortunate because I had real mentors, people who taught me how to do things like work out how to build a proper cost plan.
Right.
You'd be amazed
how
few people know how to do that.
No, I wouldn't.
And to establish a commercial deal with a client. We had one client, which ultimately he turned into a client, an employer of
right.
mine, who didn't want to pay, oddly enough.
Yeah.
Or rather, he didn't want to pay then and there. He wanted the machines to effectively earn their keep. So he was prepared to raise a letter of credit. And one way and another, we came up with a facility that required four banks,
right.
a confirmed irrevocable letter of credit from the Saudi French bank in Jeddah to their corresponding bank in London, which was Barclays.
Right.
Barclays then did a forfeiting deal, which is an old Napoleonic War funding mechanism.
Oh, my gosh.
Where you
can, lawyers are making at the moment. I can hear it.
So you can discount the value of the bills of exchange over 4 years into a payment today. But that was still in a foreign currency.
Right.
We then had a future deal on the currency so that we knew that what we were going to get as a minimum. So we'd locked in on currency. Yeah. So we did that. And then we had to pay into our bank account. And it worked.
It worked. Okay.
Goodness gracious. I don't know what would have happened if it didn't. But it did work.
And so what were you selling to them then? Machinery?
Yes.
I thought you were selling them like snacks.
No. So it was the machines to make it.
So if I was making a snack, I would like, I don't know, you know, sometimes
well,
you
like
see...
Like a packet of crisps,
things like
that. So your machines would put the crisps in, seal
it
the
would
bag.
It would make the product, transfer the product, weigh the product, package the product, and then put it into boxes.
The machine would weigh the product.
Yeah.
Right, or multiple machines, presumably.
Yeah. We're talking fairly sizable contracts in engineering terms, you know, a couple of £1 million each time. It was that approach and also the fact that we made a little bit more out of the deal than we expected. So next time I flew out to Saudi Arabia, I handed a check to this client saying, we got a bit more than we thought we were going to get. Here's the difference.
Yeah, that's very kind.
Yeah.
And he said, I never, ever thought I'd see that.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Well, that's going to help, isn't it? Mm. Yeah, as we know, in the long run, you know. Commercial break. So I just bumped into Aaron, the MD at Chime, at the coffee machine a second ago.
Oh yeah, our sponsor.
He wanted to have a meeting with us both, just to talk about the direction we're going with, and you know what he thinks he can bring to the adverts on the pod.
Okay, is he happy with them?
Well, I don't know. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, he's been eating our Kit Kats and drinking our coffee for the last 3 years.
I know that they've been in our office now for 3 years.
Yeah, using all our quantity surveyors, all our buyers, all our construction managers, our accounts department, just so they can make their software brilliant. How about that? And he wants to talk to me about making our adverts better. The cheek of it.
Chime Software, chime.co.uk.
And how far did you go at that job? So you came in running a sales team, did you?
Well, I came in at Wright as a very junior salesperson.
Right, yeah.
And
so there's obviously a journey here.
And I never really became much more than that, other than the fact that I was getting bigger and bigger projects to work on. And when that client in Saudi realised that not only was I straight in terms of doing
giving
a deal... There was also the fact that he could see that I was solving the problem of where do you put this equipment? What buildings do you require for this equipment?
Yeah.
What services do you need to be able to run this equipment?
Yeah.
And I became much more of a project manager.
Yeah.
In that niche type of
in
project.
In that niche.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And he had this aspiration to build his company into a bit of a conglomerate where he wanted to have the facility to build production lines in Saudi Arabia and within the Gulf Cooperative Council area, so the GCC countries.
Yeah.
And he wanted to go to big blue chip operators like Johnson & Johnson and say, we'll make your product and we'll make it to your quality standards and you pay us to do that.
And so were Johnson & Johnson already running their own manufacturing type things?
They were, but not in country. So they were shipping their product from their production facilities globally. They were paying import duty. They had import restrictions.
Yeah.
And they could only sell product they were making for the rest of the
world.
Exactly.
And they had enough of a market in those areas to produce, as your client realised.
Yep.
So I see. So he was going to grow a business and he was like, this guy, because a big part of that business, because I've been involved in similar projects where... sort of big kitchen facilities where the design of the equipment and again it's the services coming in, it's the backup support that's needed, it's the layout, how it works, production facilities, all that sort of jazz, mapping and so on.
Yeah.
So I can see how he's like, well, hang on a minute, this. If I really want to scale this, then he's going to need a lot of architects, engineers might not have that. So really, it's about the person, isn't it?
But truth is, it was a job. I wouldn't have called it a passion.
Right.
I was doing it because it was fun. I was doing it because I was paid a ridiculous amount of money to do it.
That's always handy, isn't it?
And
you were based in Saudi Arabia then?
Half the time.
Right, yeah.
So I was commuting back and forth on a monthly basis.
What's that like, Saudi to live in, is it?
Difficult.
Yeah, I'd imagine it is.
It's difficult. Anyway, I still sailed because my thing was sailing. I used to sail as a kid.
Oh, cool.
And through my 20s, I was sailing. And through one of the friends I made, I met his girlfriend, and through his girlfriend, I met her sister, and through those girls, I met their dad. And that character was a guy called Crichton Brown, who was one of the founding directors of McLaren International, the Formula One team, back in 1981. And long story short, Crichton, again, took on a sort of mentoring role. He said, look, what you do in what you do is exactly what we do in motor racing. Right. And people like you are like hen's teeth.
Right. Faults, bringing all the different components together.
Solving problems. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I said, oh, that's very nice of you to say. And
jibe ho.
Yeah. So anyway, we did a bit of mucking around with karting just for laughs for a few years. And then I don't quite know why, but we ended up buying a couple of Formula Ford race cars and running some young drivers, which was just an expensive hobby that didn't lead anywhere. But I was still doing stuff out in the Middle East. And it was on one occasion in 1997 when I was in Dubai that I met somebody who, his opening line was, I want to build a racetrack. And I thought to myself, Jeremy Clarkson quote coming, how hard can that be? Because Greiton had introduced me to a pile of folk who were influential in the industry. People like Barry Bland, who used to run the Macau Grand Prix. Charlie Whiting, who was the FIA race director for Formula One, but he also wore so many other hats. He was the chief inspector.
So you got your, you started meeting these people in that world.
Socially.
And networking.
Not professionally. So when this opportunity came up, I thought, well,
I can do
Make a few phone calls, see what I can do.
Yeah.
Oh, and another of the characters who I'd been introduced to was John Hogan, who at the time was the head of sponsorship for Philip Morris. He was the guy who brought Marlboro into Formula One. And anyway, we touted the idea around. It took us 4 years, but we found somebody who said, oh, I like this idea.
And who's we there?
I had a colleague in Dubai, who, the guy who said, I want to build a racetrack.
So he was the guy that said...
So he was Paul Berger. And the two of us were like Tweedledum and Tweedledummer, knocking on doors and trying to...
So what were you saying? I've got...
We got a great idea.
Right.
And the principle was, we want to build a racetrack, but we don't want to just build a racetrack. Right. We want to build a business park and a commercial venue.
Right. Okay.
So shops, restaurants, just... The whole
Absolutely.
Jazz,
like, so residential, retail,
right,
brand centres for car manufacturers, hotels.
In Saudi Arabia?
No, actually in Dubai.
Oh, so there was a specific like, was there a site?
We were just pitching the idea anywhere.
See if anyone
But we found somebody who said, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
And his name was Simon Azam. And he said, look, if you can prove to me there's $500 million of developable value around this racetrack you want to build, we're making a 20% net margin these days. I'll give you $100 million to build that racetrack, which is what it would have taken.
Yeah, it would cost $100 million.
So I thought, well, okay. That's what I did for a living anyway. I sat down and looked at the costs associated with something like that.
So what does the 500... Was it
$500 million of development value
So that
would produce a margin of 100. Yeah. So he said, right, so long as there was a minimum of that, I knew I can balance the books.
He's willing to.
So as at last year, that development had just knocked on the door of $4 billion.
Really?
So it's already
So the development value at the end of the project.
So, in fact, it's gone a bit further than they thought.
Good deal.
So, everybody looks at something like Dubai Autodrome and says, okay, well, it doesn't appear to be very busy, and it doesn't appear to be making much money, but the owners are very happy because there's no sunk cost.
Right.
Because the development cost was amortized into the developments around.
Yeah. So, they're basically holding on to the asset value is considerably more, certainly in the last case, of the build costs.
That's right. So, that was our angle, which was unique.
Yeah.
And... But I have to tell you, it's only unique in motor racing. It's exactly the model that you use when you're building a football stadium or a shopping mall or a marina or a golf course.
It's probably worth doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just stole the idea from somebody else.
And so that was the project that sort of
started
Apex.
Yep, absolutely.
And then you thought, okay, this is where I'm going
That brings me back to my lady luck analogy. I always think it's when preparation meets opportunity.
Well, so there you go, because there's no such thing as luck, is there?
Well, that's it. And so you'd been prepared in what you were doing at Rolls and then Wrights, and then you had the skills, and then all of a sudden you get an opportunity. So you know then, because often people get, someone might have said, do you fancy building a racing track? You're like, oh, I've got no idea.
Yeah.
It would have gone wrong. So I always think that's what happens. It's you're prepared through your life experiences, and an opportunity lands and you're like, well.
Yeah, but I also feel immensely grateful that I have had those opportunities come my way.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of that's luck, isn't it? But even if you... If you'd have to have been prepared to take advantage of them, I think is the point I'm making.
And your role now, so how big's your business?
We turn over about 3 million or so. But that's just in consulting fees, remember. Yeah, it's not the project cost.
Yeah, and how many sort of bodies in
Okay, full-time I've got 12 staff. I've got two in the US, I've got one in China, and the rest are in the UK.
Yeah.
But we also have long-standing relationships with companies like AECOM.
Right, of course, yeah.
And
these are big consultants. Yeah.
And they provide people for us on our projects, and it's always the same guy. So effectively, they're part of our team, and they've learned over the years exactly what we need and how to do it.
I thought you were going to say you supplied into them.
No, it's the other way.
Yeah, cool.
We often ask our guests, because the role of MD has its obviously highs and lows, what have been some of the most challenging or tough decisions you've had to make in your role as MD?
We talked about this before we started this podcast. The one that I will never forget is the day that I had to lay people off. I never wish to do that again. It was 2011. Somehow or other, we'd ridden through the financial crisis of 2008 and
9. Yeah.
Come out the other end, still reasonably healthy. We'd picked up a fantastic new project in China. We were going gangbusters on it. And then the client pulled the plug and said, I'm sorry, we're stopping.
It's not happening.
And I thought, oh, I'm not sure what to do now.
Right.
And so I have a co-director who's my lawyer, who's been involved from day one, another of the people that I was introduced to by Crichton Brown. And I called up James and I said, what should we do? And he said, you've got to slash costs now.
Mm-hmm.
Don't go down with the ship. Make sure that you can still be sailing a ship, even if it's smaller, when things pick up again. And I regret that big time because I had to lay four guys off who I consider to be essential to the business. I respected them, and to look them in the eyes and say, I'm sorry I'm letting you go, was the worst thing I ever had to do. And I vowed afterwards I would never do it again. So when we were in lockdown last year, when everything was looking a bit wobbly for everybody, I had already pre-warned my shareholders and colleagues that if we needed to cut costs, we were going to do it as a team.
Yeah.
So rather than have individuals put on furlough or let go, we were going to take a pay cut across the board as a percentage so that everybody had the same pain. And we didn't get there,
didn't happen.
Thankfully.
Yeah.
We actually got to the point where things started to wake up again in 2021. We had enough liquidity in the business through 2020 that carried us through. And so we're actually very proud of the fact we didn't make use of any of the initiatives that the government had to keep businesses going.
Did those guys move on and get good jobs?
I bet they did. I actually helped some of them to get new jobs.
Of course you did.
That doesn't change the fact that I had effectively excised a perfectly healthy part of the body. What has happened it's the law of unintended consequences that a couple of them have actually set up in competition.
Yeah, of course,
Which, you know, it's a big bad world out there. You can't stop them, and you've got to celebrate the fact that they can do that, because I trained the damn
thing. Totally agree. I think you want them, you know, when you see people doing well that you've been working either, you know, with, or they've maybe worked under you, or you know, I think
you've got to train them, don't you?
And you've got to take something out of that. I think you've got to be proud of that. I think, you know, it's good to see
people. It's a silver lining. But it was a fairly big cloud.
So,
okay, so let's have a chat about these youngsters, these whippersnappers. How do you think we are going to get them?
Have you got any thoughts on this, Clive?
Do we need to do a cultural thing?
It is a cultural thing, and it goes back to primary school.
Right.
Do you think?
Yeah, I do. And my daughter's at a school close to where we live in Buckinghamshire, and, you know, she's lucky, she's at a private school. They don't have a science block.
Right.
They don't have
a room or a sandpit.
They've got a STEM centre.
Have they?
Do you know what a STEM centre is?
Yeah, science, technology, engineering and maths.
You're putting six-year-olds into a STEM centre. It's utterly brilliant.
You think it's brilliant? I wasn't going to say if you thought it was bonkers or not.
No, it's amazing.
It is truly wonderful. It was one of the reasons we chose that school.
Right.
Because that school has clearly realised that if you're going to be fit for purpose by the time you've finished your education, you need to understand the things that the industry needs. And STEM has been a big old thing for a while now.
Yeah, well, the government have done a big push on it. I think it has got better. To the detriment, I think, I come from a more creative side, and the creatives have had a massive hit, especially in education.
There's no jobs for them.
Yeah, but it's relevant in all industries, oh, Rog. Like,
is,
the creative should be everywhere.
Well, but I think creative is a funny word, isn't it? I still consider myself creative.
So, okay, the arts. Okay, I'll call it the arts,
the
then.
Arts,
gotcha. So in a mechanical...
I really do.
If you want to compete for those cool jobs in Soho, you've got to be cool.
Yeah.
And so...
Got our upper coolness, which we're doing. We're trying.
You know, I mean, cool. You've got to have substance behind the coolness as well, haven't you?
Yeah, you do. So, the fact is, we have something similar. Our offices are in the middle of nowhere. They're three large black barns, built 500 years ago.
I mean, that sounds quite cool. Yeah.
And we've got a tennis court, which isn't used for tennis. Oh, boys use it for RC racing.
Oh, okay.
And
is that radio controlled cars?
Yeah.
And, I didn't even know that.
And one of the units has been converted to a gym.
Yeah.
So the boys go for a run, or they walk my dog, which is a great way of
say
getting the
boys,
dog.
Boys, though, any girls?
We do get them, but they're rare as hen's teeth, and that's why it's not through choice. It's that you look at the statistics.
Yeah.
Girls don't go into engineering yet in the quantities that we need them
to. Because I was, when you were talking about STEM, I was going to pipe up, because recently I did hear there was a lot on the news about women, girls going into the STEM subjects.
Yeah.
They were talking about it as if it's just doesn't, like you said.
Yeah, does it? My cousin actually is an engineer, but
is that a lady?
A girl. Yeah. But she's a rarity.
But like you said, it's not through choice at all, is
no,
it?
No, it's not. And we have had girls come and join the team, and you know, one of them, Ilana, has moved on. She now works at MIRA, the Motor Industry Research Establishment, and she was brilliant, and is still brilliant. We
so
would love
really
to have more.
It's encouraging them to do it, isn't it? And you know, girls do really well at school, don't they? Is this another sort of shift in, or maybe clarity of the sexes, is that girls tend to do better than boys at school at the moment? Is that right? So arguably
up to an age.
Is that right?
Not all the way through to 18. I think by the time of 18, it's balanced
pretty
out a bit.
Is that right?
What I found with my travels is that it's not universally the case that it is a male-dominated industry. I flew to, believe it or not, Tehran a few years ago, and what I found in Iran was completely the opposite to what I expected. To begin with, it's a completely emancipated country where women appear to have just as much autonomy as men. All of the surveyors, all of the civil engineers we were dealing with were girls.
Is that right? Interesting.
So in the construction itself, it was obviously male.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the moment you needed some kind of intellect...
Yeah.
Bring the girls in.
Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty much worked by that basis, even at home, at the office. You know, I think women are obviously a vital part of the world, obviously. But
yes, obviously.
And it's true also in China.
Oh, is that right?
Yep.
Really?
So I've been hugely impressed with the way that Chinese work. And we've had clients who are girls. We've had engineers we've worked with who are girls. And they are, to a man... brilliant.
You get.
Please forgive the mix of sexes, but they were utterly brilliant.
You get the impression, though, that China's been able to set its stall out for educating the children. You know, you do get the impression that that's no accident, and that, you know, they've got the ability to sort of not worry about the next political party changing the education. You know, there's an element, there's a bit of politics here, isn't there, really?
There is. Now, you're talking, obviously, about the construction industry, which is always going to be there. We're always going to need to have bricks and mortar. But the world of business, the world of work, is changing faster than we can even conceive.
Yes.
We're fossils, the lot of us.
Yeah.
And kids in school today don't know what they're going to do, because the jobs they're going to do haven't even been invented yet.
So this is Roger was saying this earlier, and it is so
how do you persuade
someone
to be a brickie if arguably in 15 years time there's no brickies?
Mm-hmm.
How do you convince someone?
Because you'll be 3D printing all the houses.
Yeah.
But now I sort of...
Which we might not be, but there is that...
Or we'll blow ourselves up.
But oddly enough, I reckon that engineering is never going away.
Yes.
And the need for engineers is never going to go away. But the way that you polish the outside of it and the way you sell it and the technology you put into it to control it and all of the stuff that you can now do with a little box in your hand is going to have an effect. But ultimately, we still need to have... girls and boys becoming engineers.
And that's my conclusion.
Same
in
construction, in education. Like, robots are not going to suddenly be teachers. It's never going to happen.
You think that the changes that required is actually happening at a certain point?
It's like a super tanker. It's not something that turns on a sixpence. Yeah. Mm. The educators need to change. Yeah. The mindset of a culture needs to change. And that's why I drew attention to both Iran and China, which might sound a bit odd that I'm using them as good references. But you have to remember that, like any other culture, like any other society, they have to make what they have work. And they have.
Yeah.
And they've done it in a way which I think we should learn from rather than be suspicious of.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Trip over there.
Should we get to Tehran?
Beautiful place.
Oh, yeah, I bet it is. I mean, I've never been to anywhere really in the Middle East.
I mean, it's never appealed. Like, Dubai's never appealed, really.
No, he doesn't want to go to Dubai.
And to finally finish off some quick fire questions, what is the best advice you've ever been given?
Come to me if you've got a worry. Don't come to me with a problem.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that is interesting.
Yeah.
It's like solve my problems.
Yeah, so do you...
Give me solutions, not problems.
Do you tell your youngsters coming in...
Yeah, I want to know that there's something that they're concerned about
before it escalates, snowballs. Yeah,
that's a good one. I completely misunderstood that.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Yeah. Like, which you're the same, actually, with your...
I always think it's that your job is to sort of understand when to worry. So a lot of that is about them giving you enough of the early signals.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, that's a very good point. That's a very good point. Well put as well.
Top tip for a budding mechanical engineer coming into the industry.
Be open-minded. Graft. Yeah. Be prepared to go the extra mile, because it's the self-starter in engineering who moves forwards.
Yeah.
Be an A-team player, Bells.
Yeah, we did a podcast on
A-teamers. Which is a similar sort of thing. Go in there and be the person.
Well, it's be proactive. Don't be reactive.
Yeah, be curious.
Don't
sit there waiting
to be told to do something.
Yeah.
We've had a few puddings, and they're not helpful in the business.
What would you bring to a desert island? One thing.
A boat, so I could sail home.
Would you sail home though, or just sail around the island?
No, I'd sail home.
Well, Clive, thank you for coming on. It's been so good to hear your views of the youngsters as well. I don't know if we really touched upon your role at university enough, but I think it's so important having people like you in the industry running your own business, but, you know, really trying to get those youngsters.
I think the trouble is that it's easier for people like me to do it because we're owner decision makers. Big corporations that have HR departments and have recruitment teams and the like, they're several steps removed from the person who can say, I want to do this.
Yeah.
And that's going to be hard.
Cool. So, Bells, what do you think? That was good, wasn't it?
Oh, it's great to have him on.
Wasn't it interesting that he articulated slightly better what we were thinking before that pod, wasn't it? He seemed to have it all sort of, he had a very good idea of.
Yeah, and he, you know, he really manages his team for the youngsters and getting them in.
It's part of the business, isn't it, bringing them in? And so it's good, tied up really well. Anyway, so what are you doing now?
Probably got to get back to the office, back to work,
back to work, I'm off.
Oh, actually, no, I need to find a destination for our summer party, don't I?
Yeah,
that is top of my list.
That's get that straight to the top, Bells.
I'm going to get on that.
Cool.
And then, nothing much.
Okay, cool.
But we're looking forward to seeing you all next week.
Exactly. Not quite sure who our guest is, but that tends to be the nature of this.
Aren't knocking on our doors
yet. We're just prioritising. Anyway, thanks for listening.
Remember to like and subscribe, and we will see you next week.
Take it easy. Bye.